Okay, so 2 weeks ago we started talking about graphical interaction. I reminded you about the principles of direct manipulation. I had shown you this little application that demonstrates different ways of implementing direct manipulation. This one being a bad way because you have to go through all these other things in the user interface to manipulate the object here, so it's not direct in that sense. We saw variants of this. And then we started talking about the basic vocabulary of graphical interaction, and that was the action of pointing, moving a cursor over the object of interest. We will talk later on about Fitt's law, which is the basic law that helps us design pointing techniques and measure their performance. We talked about selection. How do you activate an object once you have pointed at it? And the vocabulary of selection gestures, essentially clicks, multiple clicks. And the third one, which is a drag interaction, where you track the position of the mouse as you move it with a button pressed in general, and the importance of the feedback in this mode, when so you know what you're doing, also you know what the system thinks you're doing. And we distinguish between drag interactions, where in the end, the only things that count is the starting point and the ending point, whichever the trajectory is. So we distinguish the drag interaction from an ink, or sometimes called a mark, where the trajectory, the entire trajectory, is taken into account. Either when you draw something, or when you do a mark that is then recognized by a recognition system. So, if you take a standard system today, that is a laptop or a desktop with a mouse and a keyboard, the interactions that involve the mouse are always reducible to these three things. I would add one more, which is the action of dwelling. And dwelling is what happens when you intentionally not move the mouse. So it's weird because it's a non-action. But you know that you use dwelling. So do you have examples of when you use this to explicitly do something? Do nothing for doing something.
Can you give me a tooltip?
Yes. So a tooltip, you move the mouse and you wait because you know that if you wait there, a tooltip will.
I do it on my keyboard. I rest on a key when I want to have a special key. For example, when I write French with my keyboard, I need all these accents.
Yes.
And they appear when I rest for a second.
Yes, and so that's what we call a long click. So it is used for this kind of interface, but there are other cases where, for example, some menus appear only after a while. And so this is called a long click because you have to first click and press the button and leave it pressed for a little while until something happens.
And it's not dwelling because it's not the mouse? Or
I'm sorry?
Is it also dwelling or is it not called dwelling?
Well, it's a dwelling action that happens after you've pressed the button. So it's something we call the long click. There's a third case that I showed in a little demo, which was, it's called the spring-loaded folders in the Macintosh. So you start dragging something, and then you pause over a folder, and that folder opens, and you can move the icon into it. So that's the third case where dwelling is used. So the time out, or period of time during which nothing happens, is used to trigger something. Right? So once you have pointing, selection, which is clicks, double clicks, multiple clicks, command clicks, etc. Dwelling, which is doing a pause in your action, and dragging or inking, you've got all the basic vocabulary of graphical user interfaces. If you go to touch-based interfaces, what are the differences?
We can't do it.
You can't dwell?
Yes. Because the touch screen don't recognize our finger is on not with the actual device.
Okay. So that's an important difference, and it's called hovering. You know, a helicopter hovers over the. So with a mouse, the system always knows where the mouse is, and that's reflected in the cursor. And so when you're moving your cursor is like floating above the screen. And suddenly when you click, that it does something. With touch interfaces, most touch-sensitive devices do not track, as you said, the position of your finger unless it is touching. There are some systems that actually have hovering. There are also some tablets. If you use Wacom tablets, they can detect proximity. So when your pen tip is close to the tablet, the system can track it. And when you put it down, it detects that it's contact as opposed to just hovering. With fingers, it's not yet available in most hardware. So the system doesn't know what where you are, and so it doesn't. That means that it cannot really help you with pointing, because it only knows really about the selection action. It's only when you put your finger down that the system can track it. And that causes all sorts of problems with touch-based interfaces. So you have some examples from your personal experience, things that you found were different and annoying.
In some games, when you have to click on the character, then over to the position in order to see the path of the visit. You cannot do that on the touch screen in the sense that you cannot hover. So you have to click somewhere and hope the path will be imaginable in some strategic
yes.
games.
Yes?
I think the most horrible example are websites where you have to hover over a menu to see all the different choices, but you can't. And when you click on the menu, you get somewhere else, and you just can't get into the subsections of that website.
So. Okay. So, yes?
I think about the selection task, which is, for my mind, less intuitive in the tactile device than with the mouse.
Yes. So, the three examples, so the games, the websites, or simple navigational interface about selection, for example, when you have a list of items. These are all things that rely a lot on the pointing, and the system reacts to where the cursor is without you doing explicit actions. And if you don't have, if you don't track the position of the pointing device or finger, then you cannot do this. And so, oftentimes, especially I'm thinking of the interfaces to navigate lists, you have to touch the screen to navigate, and when you tap, sometimes it's interpreted as an action, a selection action, and sometimes just a way to navigate. So this is one important difference between touch interfaces and the mouse-based interfaces. The other one is that in touch interfaces, a lot of the systems are now multi-touch, so they can try multiple contact points. So if you think multiple contact points, you can think of it in various ways. Maybe it's different users interacting at the same time. Now, this doesn't happen often on a smartphone, but if you think of a touch table, you will have multiple people around. So a lot of interfaces assume that only one user is interacting at a time. And if you have multiple users, it will not work. A lot of interfaces are based on
I select an object, and then I go into a menu or some keyboard equivalent or something to select an action that is applied to that object. Now, if you have multiple users and only one selection, it's not going to work nicely. You're going to have to take turns to do things. If you have multiple users and they each have their own selection, then it means the system must have a way to track who is doing what. And most interactive tables, they don't know that. They see a finger, tap. And so they don't know what belongs to whom. If you had one selection per user, they don't even know, you know, whether it's one user using two hands or two users using their respective hands. So when we think of multi-touch interaction, we think of it often in the context of a single person use, a smartphone or a tablet. And we think of multi-finger gestures, like pinch gesture or things like this, which gives you more degrees of freedom than just dragging, because you control two or even several points at the same time. So that's an advantage. If we go to larger devices like tables or interactive walls, it means you have multiple users. And our interfaces are really not designed in general for multiple users. And if they are, they assume we are able to identify where the users are and which user is doing which action. So that means that in the case of what I call graphical interaction here, which is desktop interfaces, we are in a much simpler world. And even though it's simpler, we'll see it's already quite complicated. So what I did last time, I started going through a set of basic interaction tasks. So interaction tasks are the sort of the next level of abstraction over these basic gestures. And so I took inspiration from a work by Folie and Van Damme, who did that in the book on computer graphics, of this taxonomy of basic tasks that you find in user interfaces. And essentially, if this taxonomy is correct, you should be able to take any interface and analyze it and say, well, here are the input tasks, here are the selection tasks, here are the trigger tasks, etc. And if I've forgotten something, well, let me know. So we covered input tasks. The notion of an input task is that you're entering information in the system that was not in the system before. So such as text or values or positions with the cursor or trajectories. In general, you can implement an input task for a certain input task for a certain type with another type. So you could have a text field to input a number, where you have to type a number. And sometimes you want to be able to type the number because you know exactly the number and it's hard to specify with a slider. And other times you want a slider. And the other important aspect about input tasks is that they should be adapted to the type of data. So I gave this example of specifying the size of a table either with two text fields or with a grid like this where you directly specify the size. And then we move on to selection tasks, which are, I think, by far the most frequent. Because what we do as computers is we spend our time selecting among a set of values, data, information that is already in the computer. And so we looked quickly at things you know already. Which is things like the radio buttons, the checkboxes, the lists. And the distinction between these is that when you have to select within a set of objects, there are issues like what is the size of the set? Is it a small set, a big set? Is it fixed or variable? And do you want to select one object or more than one? And based on this three aspects, we have a set of selection techniques. I'm not going to go
into details since we covered it already. And I don't remember, did I stop before or after the menus?
Before.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I wouldn't have gone quickly over menus. So, if you look at menus, there are probably more papers in the literature about menus than about pretty much anything else. And there are still papers about menus. There are still people who invent new menus or new variants of menus. And I'm not sure why that is in particular, because you know, there are other aspects, even within selection tasks, that are interesting and important. I guess menus are usually the interface through which you specify commands. So that's how you specify what to do. And so the other thing is that most interfaces have menus, one way or the other. So what you have here is mostly menus that you've already encountered. The first one is the menu bar. So one of the issues you have with menus is you have a number of commands that you want to make available to the user. Now, in general, the number of commands is pretty high. So if you look at an application like, I don't know, Microsoft Word, do you know how many commands it has? Ballpark?
115?
115? Okay, better estimate somewhere?
500?
1,000? So, I didn't count on recent versions of Word. When I last did, which was about 10 years ago, there was about 150. I'm sure it's probably gone now closer to 200 or 300. To take another example, I don't know if you know Maya. Maya is a tool for 3D modeling. It's now done by and sold by Autodesk. So Maya has over 1,000 commands. Now we know from psychology, you remember the magical number? What was it?
Seven plus 2.
Yeah, 7 plus or minus 2. Yes? Miller, did you read the paper? Yes. So Miller did these experiments that showed that in short-term memory, we can hold about 7 items. And the way we deal with more complexity is through chunking. But I won't go into that. And so there is an application of this to HCI that says a menu shouldn't be longer than 7 plus or minus 2 items. If you have longer menu, it will take a lot more time for the user to scan through a menu to find where things are, and it will also be harder to learn and remember what's in the menu. So, if you want to fit 1,000 commands in menus that are 7 items long, you're going to need a lot of menus. So a number of things have been invented to manage this complexity. So one of them is the menu bar, which is a special case really of the hierarchical menu. In the menu bar, you have all the heads of the menus available at all times, which serve as a visual reminder. And then when you click on one, the menu, as you know, rolls down and you can select in the menu. So the advantage here is that you have a nice trade-off between the space used by the menu on the screen and the number of commands that are available. So by using, you know, only 20 pixels at the top of the window or at the top of the screen, you can give access to hundreds of commands. The cost, of course, is, you know, it's like everything, you trade space for time. So it takes up less space on your screen, but it takes up more time to get to the menus. Every time you need a menu, you have to go to the menu bar, click, sometimes navigate because you don't know in which menu it is until you go down. So typically you have one pointing action from wherever you are on the screen to the menu title, then menu shows up, then you need a second pointing action to go down. If you want something more efficient, you take fixed buttons. So usually they have icons instead of text in them. But a fixed palette is a tool palette, a toolbar, whatever you want to call it, is a menu. It's a set of options, and you can select one of them. Now here we have the opposite trade-off. The palette can be next to where you work, so very accessible, very quick, but it takes up space. And I don't think I have it in this slide, but you know, you can play with Word and open every possible toolbar, and you're left with three lines of text for editing. Okay, so time versus space. Here's another point in this design space, contextual menus. So with a menu bar, the concept is something that is stable. In a well-designed application, the menus in the menu bar, the titles of the menu do not change, and the content of the menu doesn't change. So there is stability. Stability is important because we learn, and I'm sure in applications that you know well, you move to the menu and to the submenu before the system has even had time to display it. So we call this muscle memory. Of course, our muscles don't have this kind of memory, so it's just an expression. But I think it's very evocative. It's, you know, your arm knows where to go without your brain having to consciously think about it. If your menus change all the time, of course you cannot do this, you cannot learn. So around 2000, Microsoft came out with Windows NT, and they were extremely proud of their new menu system, because they had done an adaptive menu system. I'm sure it's still available somewhere in Windows, because they never take anything away. And their idea was, well, as we all know, there are commands that are used more often than others. So what they did is a system that was tracking your usage of menus, and then after a while, it will show you in the menus only the commands that we're using the most often, and hiding the others. And to find the others, if you ever needed them, you had to go to the end of the menu and do some extra click to bring back the other commands. And of course, because this thing was adapting all the time, your menus were changing, you know, under your feet, so to speak, all the time. And the thing that is amazing is that they did that when, at the time, there were papers published years before, in fact, by Ben Schneiderman, explaining that if the content of a menu changes, you are less efficient with it. So the data was there, the research was there, they still did it, and guess what? It failed. They took it away. Anyway, sometimes, you know, we researchers get upset by these kind of things. Anyway.
Would it be the same if the menu items would shrink over time until they would vanish, that the user could accommodate over time? That makes sense. So you get less items over time, but still have the opportunity to get your item back when you see it shrinks and you know you need it more often or something.
Well, it'd be something worth studying. It's true that if you do something that disappears progressively rather than suddenly, you may be able to adapt to it. The problem you get into is when you navigate the menu structure of an application, it tells you what this application can do. If some things have disappeared, you're not going to find out. So the things you need information about are going to disappear. The reason we gray out commands in the menu system, there's two reasons. One is stability. By graying out the command, I'm telling you cannot use it now, but it's there. So your muscle memory can still work. But the other thing it tells you is there is this command. It's not available now, but if this is the command I need, I can see it's there. Now, in a well-done system, you'd have a way to ask the system, well, why is this grayed out now? This is really what I want to do. Why aren't you letting me do it? And the system could tell you, well, oh, you need to select an object of this type or do this or do that. So I think that the issues we run into, and especially in menus, but it's a general thing in HCI, is these trade-offs. And the trade-offs oftentimes are between novice users and expert users. Although I think this is a bad way to look at it. Because even if you've used the software for 20 years and you are expert at it, there are things in that software you don't know. There are parts of Word that I don't know about. And so if one day I know I need them, if I do, I never do mailing, for example, with Word. I know it's in there. If I want to do this one day, I need to be able to discover it. And if the answer to discovery is go read the manual, it's not going to work. So how do you make interfaces that reveal all they can do and still be efficient for expert users? And that's a very tricky thing. So the reason we have all these types of menus is because there are different kinds of trade-offs. And in my experience, the best thing is to let the user really customize the interface to his taste. So we'll see this in a moment. So with menu systems, we have this normally fairly static structure. It's okay to have menus that change if it's something like the menu with all the currently open windows, or if it's the menu of the fonts that are installed in the system, because that doesn't change very often. The window menu or the document menu, you know, it makes sense that it would reflect what's currently open. So the fact that it should be stable is not an absolute rule, but for the commands themselves, it should stay stable. So one way to make things, to gain the efficiency that we lose by making this big menu system at the top there, is by using contextual menus. Because in fact, statistically, a lot of the items in those menus are grayed out. So they're unusable. So another way to look at it is, instead of telling the user, well, you can't do this, another way is to tell it only the thing you can do. So a contextual menu is something that appears in context. So it's usually triggered in graphical user interfaces with the right click, or sometimes a long click. And it's supposed to only show you the commands that apply to this particular object. So what you gain is speed, because the menu appears where you are, so you don't have to do a round trip to the menu bar. If the system is well designed, you will try to make these menus, even though they are contextual, to have them fairly stable. So, you know, if you have the same commands, then they should be in the same place, in the same order, things like this. And so here you save space, because there's nothing on the screen. You save time, because the menu appears where it is, and only shows you what's available at the moment. So what do you lose? Something has to give.
We lose a feed forward.
Yes, feed forward. So you have to know that you can right click to get a menu. And I know it seems, as I've said in the first class, I think, don't consider yourself normal users. I mean, you're here presumably because you like computers. Most people don't like computers. Or most people don't like using computers. They just have to. They just try to, you know, get their job done using computers. So don't think of your own experience with computers as representative as everybody else's. Right? So the idea that you are naturally exploring an interface by clicking everywhere and you have built up this knowledge over the years is not shared by the rest of the population. Knowing that you can right click to bring a menu, if the system doesn't give you some feed forward, is going to be very hard. I'll take a very simple example. in the Mac interface. I don't think many people know that my cursor is on the top here on the title bar. If I click here, nothing happens. I mean, I can move the window, and most people think the title bar is just for moving windows. Turns out that if I right-click, I have a menu of where this file is. I can bet you 95% of Mac users don't know that. You guys didn't know that? I'm disappointed. I don't know if you're going to pass. Okay. Is there anything else you can do with the title bar?
Maximize it if you double click.
Yeah, but that's not interesting. Well, there's this icon here. It tells me, well, it's an Excel spreadsheet. It turns out that if I click on it, I can move it. And I can, for example, get it into my mail and send that file as an attachment to that email.
You didn't know that
either. How did you get into this program? Well, but that should tell you something, is that once you know it, it's very useful. But there's no clue in the interface that there's a menu hiding behind the title. There's no clue that this icon, even though it's the same icon you have on your desktop, the visual language of the Mac interface only tells you that icons are manipulable in the Finder. If you see them elsewhere, they're just decoration. So how would you fix this?
You could simply highlight it when you hover over it.
Yeah.
Yeah, but still you would hover by accident.
Yeah, but that's fine, I think. Okay. And I think there's two things you could do. The first one is you could change the title so it looks like a pop-up menu. In the Mac interface, they would have a border around it and a little down arrow on the right. And if you see that, you say, oh, I can click, and I have a menu coming up. So you could do this in the title bar. Maybe if you don't want to make the interface visually cluttered, you could only show that when your mouse goes over it, so it's not always there. And for the icon, yes, you could have a little tooltip when you go around there. But there are many more things that, and there are probably things I don't even know that are in there that are not visible. And so that's a problem in many user interfaces, is that a lot of the information and the capabilities are hidden. And that's a problem with contextual menus, pop-up menus, and we'll see it with other techniques.
In mobile application, it's really common to see coach marks when you are in the application that highlight and explain for first time
yes.
how to use it. And you don't need to point to that area. I don't know if it's a good strategy, but
I think in general the help systems that are built into the applications are very, very poor. And it's a case, for example, where Apple has gone backwards and then gone forwards a little bit. So the coaching mode that you talk about, it's pretty frequent on for some reason on smartphone and tablet applications. And I guess it's because these are being used by an even wider range of the population. It's good, but if you only get it once, sometimes, you know, that's not the right time for me. You know, I really want to get my work done. I don't want all these things, you know, popping up saying, oh, try this new feature or this or that. And when it's gone, where do I find it? So I think there should be a more explicit way of turning on help in the user interface. And the reason I'm saying Apple has gone backwards on this is because they did have this mode. They did have a mode where you say, well, give me the bubbles. And you have a lot more tooltips about everything you did. And of course, after 5 minutes, it drives you crazy, but you turn it off. And at least you have this notion that, well, I want to be sort of learning and discovering things, or I'm busy and working. So that's one answer to this. Another answer is, in the help menu here, you have a search bar. And so here, if you don't know what you're looking for, you can type, I hope, hello, timeout. And it shows you all the commands that have the letter F4M in there. And if I go on one of them, it will show you where it is. Now, they used to have something a lot more sophisticated that was called Apple Guide, where it didn't show you only about the things in the menus, but other tasks. And when you ask for help, it would drive you through the process. It would draw a red circle around the interface element you need to activate, and it would tell you the next step is to do this, to do that. So if you, and that was before macOS 10, it was called Apple Guide, and I thought that was really a great way of having sort of tutorial-like features inside every application.
Something
and
like
for
that.
The developer, all you had to do was to create little scripts, and then all the fancy animation and driving the user was done for you.
It's related with the settings, when you search something in the settings.
Yes. So in settings, they've done here, you mean?
Yes.
The halo?
Yes, something
yeah.
like that.
So here, if I start typing, it will give me the list, but also put this highlight, this spotlight, on which items match that query. So that's to say that a lot more could be and should be done about helping users. Because you know, these applications become really humongous. I mean, you look at, you know, we're far from the 7 plus or minus 2 here. And you go here, and then you have submenus. These are not too bad. There are a number of places where you have submenus, etc., etc. So it's really daunting for a new user. And even, I mean, I've been using Excel since it exists. But with every new version, I feel that there are things I lose because they've changed them. I don't know where they went, and I have other things to do than try to find them again. And I usually, you know, manage my way without them. So this was a long side discussion about this notion of discoverability in user interfaces, and that's really important, and it's very hard to do well, because if you do a little more tooltips or things like this, it will annoy the users who use the application a lot. And you have two general approaches to this. One is make the system smarter, but I think in general this doesn't work, because humans tend to outsmart computers still. So, you know, making the system smarter would be to say, well, you know, after I've done, I've shown this a number of times, I'm going to stop showing it and things like this. Well, how do you do it? It's the same user standing in front of a computer and things like this. So, this notion of putting more, quote, intelligence in the system, I think in general, doesn't work. If you've ever been confronted with Clippy, on folder, you know what I'm talking about. The other approach is really to empower the user himself. And give the user explicit ways of saying, I want more help, I want less help. Have standard ways of getting help, like the ones I showed. So, and that you can only learn really by testing with real users, because it's very hard to fine-tune properly. Okay, so hierarchical menus. So that's something that works with all of the above menus. And the idea is that if you have more items to stuff into a menu, you can put them in the submenu. Now, again, there is ways of doing this right and wrong. One thing is, if you can avoid a hierarchical menu, avoid a hierarchical menu. It's a pain. I don't know if you remember from the Xerox Star demonstration, where on several occasions it says, well, there goes a bar at the top, and it says, this is not the menu bar, this is not the menu bar. And there is a menu, in fact, at the right of this bar, and it says, remember what it says?
This is what they didn't have time to find a better way to.
Right. So we put in the menu the stuff we didn't have time to get rid of or to make accessible some other way. And I think this is a very good philosophy. But history has gone the other way. It's like we stuff as many things we can into menus and we let the users figure it out. So, you know, with the hierarchical menu, there's no limit to how much stuff you can put into those menus. You should avoid it. In particular, because it makes discovery even harder, because you have to go into the submenus to find things. And selection in a submenu can be very frustrating. So here's the story. I have my cursor here. I'll bring a real cursor. Then I have to go down on an item. Usually I have to wait a little bit for the submenu to appear. And then I have to... When go? And then I have to traverse the tunnel. I have to move to the right very carefully. Because if I get out of... Come on, cursor, don't disappear on me like this. If I leave this tunnel, then I've lost my submenu. And then finally, I get to the submenu, and then I do a selection again. And sometimes I have to go into a third level. It doesn't have to be that way. And in fact, if I'm here, I'm going to try to find one with a big submenu. They're all tiny. So if I'm here, so you know, I have to go very carefully. And so if you're thinking, I've talked about Fitts' law, which was the time it takes to reach a target of a certain size. There is a version of it called the steering law, which is how to move your cursor inside a particular path. And this is what I'm doing here. I'm doing steering. And the law says that it's really proportional to the height of the tunnel. So it's very hard to go there. But on the Mac, it turns out that I can go diagonally, and it does work. If I go sufficiently fast, I can reach the submenu, and it didn't disappear. Now, if I do the same thing, but slowly, after a while, the submenu disappears, so I can continue selecting in my menu. And in fact, when you use it, and it's something, you know, I don't know which project you have chosen, but if you have chosen something with menu, if you try to program this, getting it right is extremely hard. Because if I don't have the right threshold, the submenu is going to look like it's sticking to me. I can't get rid of it. If I make it too sensitive, you know, it will go out as soon as I do the wrong thing. So I'm actually not sure what algorithm they're using. I think it's based really on the dynamics of the gesture and speed and things. But it's very hard to get right. And something that drives me absolutely crazy on websites is, of course, no website implements this. So every time you have a menu on the website, you are stuck with a tunnel traversal. And there is no reason, really, that you couldn't do it on the web as well. It's not that hard. And the fact is that if you build an application on the Mac, you don't have to do anything. If you build a submenu, that's the way it works. It's part of the toolkit. It's done for you. If you build a web page, well, you have to do it yourself.
You shouldn't put menus in web
page. I'm sorry?
You shouldn't put menus in a web page.
That's true too. That's true too. That's another debate. But if you have to, if you're told to, you should at least do it well.
Yeah, if the designers tell you have to put a menu, you have to do that.
Yes.
Because the designer rules the web.
Well, the thing is, the web has become many different things, and part of it is an application platform now. And so if you're doing... But I agree with you fundamentally. The you shouldn't have interface elements programmed inside web pages. Now, the last one on this page is the pull-off menu, which is, again, something that has disappeared. but was a very nice way of trading off space for time. As you remember, with the pull-down menu, I save space because I only need the space for the menu bar, but it takes time because I have to go to the menu bar all the time and then go to the menu. With a palette, it takes space on the screen all the time, and so when I don't need it, it gets in the way. So, pull-off menus, to my knowledge, were invented by Apple for HyperCard, so around 1985. And they had a tool menu, and it's interesting, they only have one menu you could pull out. And essentially the way it works is you click in the menu bar here, and if you do a fast gesture, the menu is pulled out of the menu bar and becomes a fixed palette. And so now it stays on screen, and you can select here, you can bring it next to where you're working, and you have the equivalent of a tool palette. When you're done with it, it has a little close box, you close it, and it's done. When I say you tear it out, in fact, you tear a copy of the menu. The menu stays in there for stability reasons and all that. So you're really pulling a copy out of it, you're turning it into a tool palette. So,
it still exists in GTK.
Yes, good. In fact, it does exist also in things like Excel, or is it Word? Well, the one I know is in Word. I'm going to have to launch Word. It'll take half an hour.
Command space?
Yeah, no, I'm not a keyboard guy. Okay. Well, it's my report in Jerry Zabidis. So here, if I have these menus on the right, well, you notice there's this thing here? And, oh, it has a tooltip. Click to make this menu float. Okay. And you click, and then it turns into something completely different, which is kind of surprising. But it has been turned into, let's take this one. It has been turned into a floating palette. And so now I can do this and this, although I'm not sure I should, for this particular document. Okay, so it is still there, but you know, it's clunky. I mean, you have this thing, you have to know there is this thing, and then, I mean, it would be a lot more intuitive if you've seen it once, and there is an initial learning step, I agree, to be able to tear it away, and it comes, you know, with the mouse. But at least it's not completely lost. Okay, so these were menus that, maybe apart from the last one, you had seen before. Now, linear menus are a stupid idea. Why? What's wrong with them?
Some items are closer to the mouse than more closer.
Yes, all items are different distances from the cursor, so the further away the item, the longer it takes to select it. And designers know that intuitively because they put the more frequent items towards the top in the menu bar, and they put the other ones towards the bottom because they know it takes longer to go to the bottom. So in 1982, that's 1 year after the Xerox Star, 2 years before the Macintosh, so it's not like recent, Dom Hopkins invented the pie menu. And the pie menu is a menu that looks like a pie, or a pizza, depending on your case. So it's a circle, and it has slices. And the idea is that the pie menu appears, the center appears where the cursor is. It's designed to be a contextual menu, a pop-up menu. So say with a right click, this menu appears, and the items are organized in a circle around it. That means now we have equality of treatment. All items are the same distance from the cursor. You can can have hierarchical pie menus, so you can make it so if I go into this slice here, then the sub menu appears, and it's circular as well, so I can have unlimited hierarchy. And selection type is constant. I just need to go into the right direction. Now, that's a very nice feature. Now, if you have 20 items, it's not going to work so well. Because if you have 20 items, the slices are smaller. But if you share your slice with 20 people, you get less of the pie. So, typically, the slices being smaller, you have to travel a longer distance to reduce the risk of an error. Which also means the menu has to be bigger, it's using up more space. So, the conventional wisdom about this is that radial menus should have up to 8 items. And when I say up to 8, you know, you either do 2, 4, 6, or 8. Don't try 7 or 5. So, 8 is, so those have 6. Those 2, I don't have an 8 menu one. But 8 is very nice because you have up, down, left, right, and then the diagonals. And this also plays very nicely with our motor control, because we are much better at performing a gesture in a given direction than a gesture of a specific length. So Fitts' law doesn't apply to this. Well, it does a little bit. The more slices you have, the more time it takes. But with an 8 menu items, you can select with your eyes closed. And in fact, that inspired Gordon Kernbach in 93, so about 10 years later, to create what he calls marking menus. Now, there is an argument between Hopkins and Kernbach, because Hopkins pretends that he invented that too. I don't know. When you read the papers, it's not obvious. Gordon Kernbach did his thesis about marking menus. There are stuff in marking menus that were not in Hopkins' work, so. The idea with marking menus is, well, first of all, he redesigned the layout, so it doesn't look like a pie anymore, sorry. But it looks like this. Visually, the advantage is that this doesn't hide as much of the stuff behind. So you keep more visibility over the context. This is particularly bad because you're acting on the object that's underneath in general, and you just hide it with this big thing. So that works better for that. Now, even though, so the labels are here, that's another problem with marking menus, is writing text is not easy in those slices. Here, you can write text more easily. However, even though this is a visual layout, the in terms of selection, it is still those quadrants that are used. And so, the idea behind marking menus is you can select by a quick gesture, in which case the menu doesn't even show up. So if you know, hello, take a seat. either you come in front or. So the idea is that the menu doesn't show up immediately when you right click or put the pen down. You have to do a dwell. You have to pause for a little bit for the menu to come. And that's a very nice way, in fact, to distinguish between a novice use or an expert use. When you don't know what to do in an interface, you tend to hesitate. When you hesitate, you do nothing. And if the system detects that you've started to do something and then you stop in the middle, it's like you don't know what to do. Well, it may be also that you're getting a text message or something else, but in general, it means you don't know what to do, so maybe that's a good time to give you a little bit more help. So this is exactly the way marking menus work. You touch the screen, you pause, and the menu appears, you get regular menu selection. You do a gesture like this quickly, the menu doesn't show up. When you lift the pen, it will flash the name of the command to give you feedback that you just selected that command, and that's it. Here we have a gesture that selects in a two-level marking menu. So I've gone into that item, and there's a sub-menu, and then I've gone to the item to the right. And what Kurtenbach did that I think is definitely not into Hopkins' work is the notion that these gestures are recognized independently of their size. So you can do a small gesture, a big gesture. It doesn't have to be the size of the original menu. It can be bigger, it can be smaller, it's scale independent. The very nice thing about this is that you naturally transition from novice use to expert use just by doing the thing a bit faster. When you become better at things, you do them faster. When you do it faster, the system gets out of the way, it doesn't show you the menu anymore. I can also start quickly, I can do this first gesture quickly, in which case the first menu doesn't appear, then I stop here, because I know I'm in a submenu, but I don't remember where to go, in which case the submenu is going to show up at this point, and then I can finish my selection. Now, the papers that have described these menus also include experiments about the performance. What they found is that with marking menus, compared to regular linear menus, you could go how much faster, do you think?
Three times.
You read the paper. Yes, three times. Now, three times, you have to realize this is unheard of. You know, if you do a technique and you're 10% faster than the best existing technique, I mean, you're golden, right? So, having something that is three times faster is absolutely amazing. The thing that is more amazing is that I'm sure you've never used one of these. I don't know. You should go out in the streets and demonstrate. And
I think the most maybe too impressive.
Yes?
No, not precise enough for compared to pens on the touchscreen. So with the mouse, sometimes miss the not mistake, but miss the
mouse. Yes. Well, Kurtenbach did his experiments with both pens and mice, and it is true that you have to have the recognizer be a bit different for the two cases, because we don't have the same control over a mouse and pen. Plus, on the mouse, you have the mouse acceleration that distorts thing. But if you do this fine-tuning, you can have something that is as good with a mouse as it is with a pen and with a finger. So, yes, it takes some work to do it right, but you can get it right. And frankly, I don't know why this is not more widespread. There is no patent on those menus. There's no patent. So there's not even that excuse. If there had been, it would be expired by today. The only places where you see pie menus, so you've never seen any pie menus?
Yes. There is a pie menu in the browser in Android.
So, yeah. Firefox, I think, started it. But the places where they first appeared were SimCity, because Don Hopkins went to work at, I don't know, at his
house.
Yeah.
Oh, yes. Yes.
Yes. And the other example is Maya, this 3D software I was talking about, because Gordon Kurtenbach did his PhD in Toronto, went to work at what at the time was called Elias Wavefront, which was a company making Maya. Started the research group there and talked them into having pie menus into Maya, although they were in addition to the existing menu structure, so users could have a choice. But it's interesting, and then there's it popped up into Firefox at some point, and then now in Android. But you know, a lot of the time, it has to be the people who've done the invention who carry it over into products. People don't pick up on these things. I don't know why.
But are there toolkits available? that you can easily integrate them?
No, and that's the problem.
Because then
that's
you run into something your environment offers you.
Exactly, and in the course on toolkits, I will say that again. It's like if you don't give the developers an easy way to do, say, marking menus, they're not going to program them. You know, it's a lot of work, and it's particularly hard to do right. I mean, you can do a quick and dirty thing, but it's not going to work well, and people say, oh, you know, that doesn't work. So it has to be in the toolkit, and it has to be done well. And why? So now, to be absolutely fair, there are some problems with marking menus.
The same that pop-up menu?
I'm sorry?
The same problem with the pop-up menu.
So there is a discoverability issue that we talked about before. There is also the fact that when you start this on the side of the screen, there's a little problem because you can't see the whole menu. So you have to warp things to the left to see everything, and that can be disconcerting. The fact that it's limited to 8 items require more design work to make your menu system fit into that frame. Although, personally, I find, even though I agree that 8 items is the ideal number, you can go to 10 or 12 and you still have something usable. And so there are a few issues, but they are not worse than the ones we have with linear menus. Okay, so that's all for selection tasks. This is a screenshot I like, even though it's very ancient now. Because it was showing in one, this was a
Photoshop.
No, it was macOS 9, the equivalent of preferences, system preferences. And so in one thing, you have a whole bunch of different selection techniques. You have this list with icons here, so you select in the list, and there's a scroll bar, and you select new icons, you have radio buttons, you have a slider here. You have this thing to set up some cache memory thing with little arrows that cycle through a number of predetermined days. Here, if you click on the date, you have little arrows showing up next to them to change the date, etc., etc. So here you had a way to, with these little arrows, navigate the set of background patterns and things like this. And so this, I mean, this is something that illustrates what happens if you try to make the selection techniques adapted to each type of objects you're editing, rather than always using the text fields and the same basic elements. This is on the left is the Photoshop tool palette. So I need to move on. I don't know what time it is, but this doesn't tell me. So trigger tasks. So I said that we had the pointing elementary action and then the selection action where you say, okay, go do it. So at a high level, what I call the trigger task is how you tell the system to activate a command. And menus are, of course, a major way to trigger commands, but it's not the only one. So buttons is the other one that you know very well. So I'm not going to, I mean, you know, we could talk about ways to activate buttons, but we need to get moving. Drag and drop is one that is important. And drag and drop is one of these techniques that has a great advantage in that the action you trigger depends on what it is you're moving and what is you moving it to. And I illustrated this before with iconic interaction, where depending on whether I'm grabbing a file or something else and I'm dragging it to the trash or to a folder, different things happen. So that's very good, but as we saw in this little demo with the icon in the title bar, there is the issue of discoverability with drag and drop. How do you know what is draggable and what is not?
It happened to me in a project.
Yes?
My user stood looking at the screen and said, so where do I click to start?
visual language that things, some things look draggable and others don't. As I showed before, the same icon, if it's on your desktop, you think it's draggable. If I put it in the menu bar, you don't even think about it. If it had been like this from day one, you would expect it to be draggable. It's the same thing with text. You know, if text is not inside a kind of text field, we don't think of it as being selectable. And oftentimes, something that happened still recently with my mother was about an error message. And having to do a screenshot so I can read her message seems silly. But she couldn't select the text of the error message in the message box. So again, we have this issue of discoverability. With drag and drop, there's in fact two issues. One is how you discover what you can drag, and how you discover where you can drop. So the what you can drag is a combination of the visual language, and it could have a little bit more feedback. Objects could, if you hover or dwell over an object, not necessarily with a tooltip, it could be with some other visual cue, it could tell you, well, I am draggable. This is not often done in interfaces. And the drop, you have this notion of drop area or drop zone. But so what happens is that when you drag over something where you could drop the object, the target highlights. So we saw this with folders, for example. It highlights really well. You can drag here. It's very useful if you have a file and you drag it onto several applications and you see which one responds. But if you think of it, that means you're doing all the work. You have to probe every target one by one. A different way would be that when you start dragging something, all the drop area highlight, or maybe all the non-drop area sort of kind of gray out, so it shows you all the possible destination. And that would be difficult. I don't need a system that does that really. So drag and drop, very powerful, but discoverability problem. Gesture interaction, even better and even worse. So imagine you have a pen-based interface or a finger-based interface. It works too with mouse, but the mouse was really not designed for drawing or writing. So now the idea is that you draw marks. So the basic thing here is to draw ink on the screen. And then the system, when you lift the finger, looks at what you've done and tries to interpret it with a gesture recognizer. So here's a little vocabulary of gestures. When I'm making standard shapes like squares and circles, it will create the corresponding object. It will beautify it. It will look like a nice rectangle or a nice circle. If I use a gesture that crosses itself towards where it started. So it's a lasso, and it's a way to select all the objects either inside the lasso or that overlap the lasso. So depending on the case, this rectangle here would or would not be selected. But it's very natural to circle things. Here is an example of something for moving or copying. With an ink-based interface, it's maybe a bit less natural. The idea is that you do a dragging gesture, so you move the object. If you want to copy it, that was inspired by a particular interface called gedit, done by Bill Buxton. If you do a little C at the end of your gesture, it means copy, so it's a mnemonic gesture. So you do this, you move, you do this with a little C, you copy. Deleting, of course, it's just so we erase the object. And then for specific types of data, you can have specific gestures. So this is a musical score editor where I can draw notes here on the staff. And in one gesture, I can specify what note it is, depending on where I start, and what duration it is, depending on how I finish the mark here. And this is a lot more efficient than systems where you have to specify the duration first, and then you put the note, and you specify the duration, and you put the note. Here you do it in one gesture, and in a way that is very similar to what you would draw on paper. For a spreadsheet, you can imagine gestures for frequent commands like inserting a column here, selecting cells just by going over them, and computing a sum by writing a sigma sign in the cell. So gesture interaction is very, well, gesture interaction that is based on recognizing the marks that you've drawn can be very powerful. There are two problems. One we talked about is discoverability. How do I know which commands are available? Well, there are no really good techniques except a cheat sheet that shows you, well, here are the gestures, but that's not very interactive. In our group, we build a system called Octopocus. I'll show you the video after the break, because I have to find it. That helps discovering gestural vocabulary. So that's one issue. There's a second one, though. So do you know what it is? Have you only used gesture-based thing? What problem?
Recognizing it?
Right. Recognizer. If the system doesn't recognize what you have drawn, it's annoying. And there are different types of things that can happen. Either the system doesn't recognize it at all. And that's not too bad, because the system did nothing. What's worse is that if you did one thing and the system recognized another, because then it triggered the other command, and it's not what you wanted, so you need to undo it and then find a way to do the one you wanted to do in the first place. And so there's no general and good answer about this. If you look at touch-based interfaces this day, they use a very, very limited gestural vocabulary. In fact, given the number of apps out there, of course, some do gesture recognition. But the basic vocabulary that is used across application doesn't do much gesture recognition. It recognizes flicking gestures, it's recognizing pinching. That's 90% of what you do. So, I don't really call this a gestural interface, but it's hard to do right and to address the issues of recognition properly. I'm going to speed up a little bit for the last categories here. Navigation tasks. Well, that's also a very important category, because more and more we deal with larger and larger amounts of information. So a lot of our time is spent navigating stuff. So here I'm looking at navigating a large 2D surface. I'm not looking at navigating, say, a long list or a hierarchical structure. I think those of you who take the class on information visualization will look at other navigation techniques. So the scroll bar was invented to help navigate content that was longer than the window. There's two problems with scroll bars. One is that it forces a division of attention, because I have to click on the scroll bar and manipulate it. And in general, to manipulate it, I have to look at it, because on some systems that I will mention, as soon as you leave, the cursor leaves the scroll bar, it resets the scrolling position. But of course, I'm not interested at looking at the scroll bar itself. I'm interested in the content. So I have to constantly go back and forth, and that's what we call division of attention. Now, we use scroll bars in this way less and less, because we have mice with scroll wheels, and that's been a big progress. But there is another question, which is the direction of scrolling. And I think this is a very interesting thing, because most people that you put in front of a scroll bar for the first time, they will, and you give them a scroll wheel, a mouse with a scroll wheel, and a scroll bar, they will be confused. And the problem is what it is you're controlling. Now, you're looking at me like he's crazy. I mean, what's his problem with scroll bars, right?
Do we control the sheet or the screen moving?
Right.
I realized more that when the last update of the operating system that you can, the gesture is inverted. Like,
yes.
You go down and the file goes down, but the bar goes up. And
that's another thing, at least in
no,
Safari.
No, I consider it more natural.
In Safari, I think the actual scroll bar is hidden until you start scrolling. So maybe there's content
yes.
down there and you don't know.
Okay, so let me explain what's going on here. Here I have a scroll bar, something that you take for granted is the fact that to have the page go up, I have to move down, right? Now, to you this is natural. For a lot of people, if you give them the document where the scroll bar is in the middle and say, get to the top, I guarantee you it'll be 50-50. Mm. And that's an optimistic estimate. It's not natural, it's logical once you think about it and once you've been explained that, well, the scroll bar is really the whole document, this is the part you see, and of course if you want to see the top of the document, you have to go to the top of the document. But I'm not interested in the scroll bar, I'm interested in the document. I want to go to the top. And the top is this way. And so, I should be going down. Now, of course, this is what happens if you are, I don't think I have the mode here in Word, but you know, in Acrobat, I have this little hand here where I can drag the content to the right. So you get this crazy thing that in Acrobat, if you are in here, you have to click and go down to get towards the top of the document. But if you are here, you have to click and go up. I mean, you have to admit that this is crazy. And then you have the scroll wheel. And so the scroll wheel, what it is doing? Well, what it's doing is that it's attached to documents. So you need to scroll it down to go towards the top. Or is it the other way around?
No, I think it's with the scroll.
Anyway.
If you had one, you knew, right? You would know, but when you start thinking about it, it makes no sense.
And then, yes? And then this old one doesn't move to the sides, so if you want to use it, you can't really use it because you have to still use the normal scroll bar to go to the sides to see the rest of the text.
Yeah, if you have a scroll wheel as opposed to
the
yes?
latest scroll
yeah,
wheel that lateral movement.
Yeah.
And then on top of that, Apple created the iPad, where all scrolling is done by what I call direct scrolling, where you move the content. And then they decided that they wanted to make the Mac more consistent with the touch-based interface, and they reversed the way the scroll wheel works, or the trackpad. So it used to be that on the trackpad, what I would have done before would be to control the thumb here. So it used to be that I would have to go up to get towards the beginning of the document. But here, what I'm doing now with the trackpad is that conceptually, I'm dragging the document itself, not the view over the document. And so they reversed it. And this is something I want to study. And so if there's one of you interested in this, I want to study how quickly people adapt to this reversal. So I want to, and I think we're running out of time of people who are using it the other way, or maybe we'll have to take Windows users, because my experience is that it's annoying at the beginning, but very quickly you adapt, and going back is very strange.
Oh, how much time is very quickly? Because it took a while for me.
For me, it was 2 weeks. If you want
okay.
Yeah, well, for me, it was weeks also.
Okay, well, but I would like to see if this if it's the same between nerds like you and
me. Yeah, I considered it quite natural, and now I have problems when I go back to Windows.
Yes.
Yes, that's the problem, that each time I switch to the other scroll style.
Yeah, but that's what's really hard, is when you have multiple
I actually switched to it, and then I switched back after a time, because it was so annoying going into a normal computer.
So. Okay. Well, so I find it interesting that we get different reactions. I think it's really interesting study to make, to see how people actually adapt to this thing. And what I would love is to find people who've never used a computer and see what the natural, because they call it natural scrolling on the Mac. And is it that natural? So that was direct scrolling. There was something at some point called automatic scrolling. That's something that's still around and that I hate, is you take an object and you want to move it to a part of the window that is not visible. And so when you get next to the side of the window, things start scrolling under your feet. And usually...
See, it's either too fast or too slow.
Yeah, it's either too fast or too slow, exactly. It's never the right way. So direct scrolling, very good. Automatic scrolling, I don't like it. And the problem is that you're controlling two things, really. And so in the tool I developed that used bimodal interaction, I was using one hand to move the object and the other hand for scrolling. And on many laptops today, when you have the trackpad, you can have a mouse or the trackpad on RealtyTouch. So you could actually do this, use one hand for moving the object and the other hand for scrolling, and you control the complete task. The last part here is zooming. So panning is fine. Scrolling is also called panning, like panoramic. And so when you combine with zooming, we call this pan and zoom. And now, you know, with Google Maps and all that, pan and zoom has now become something very well known. It was not really just a few years ago. And in fact, there are many interfaces where you can control the zoom, but only in discrete steps. So if you go to Photoshop, you don't have a way, at least last I tried, because I'm not a big user of Photoshop, you didn't have a way to zoom in your document continuously. You could say, well, I want 100%, or even in Word, in fact.
I'm sure that there is a way, but
so, you know, I have this thing here, and I can say, well, 125 or 100 or 200.
I
can enter the number. I don't want to enter a number. I want a slider. That's crazy.
You can try something with control, shift, whatever.
I'm sure there's a way, as you said. There is always a way. What I like on the Mac is that if I type control and I scroll my thing, I can zoom in the whole thing. That's continuous zooming. We are wired for continuous zooming, right? So it's insane that with the computers we have today, we don't have continuous zooming everywhere.
Actually, in the Windows version of Word, you have the scroll to zoom. You have a scroll bar to zoom in the bottom right.
Okay.
And you don't have it on Mac.
Yeah. Well, we're getting there. That's good news. Let me try to wrap this up. I think I have two more. Yeah, transformation. So, second to last category, property and parameter specification tasks. So when you want to specify a command, usually you have three things to do. You want to say, I want this command, I want to apply it to this object, and I want the additional parameters to this command. You know, what we just did was zooming. Well, zooming is a command. I want to apply it to, say, the document, but I also need to tell, well, what is the zooming factor? And maybe I want to control it continuously or not, but you always have this object, command, parameters. So the standard ways to specify parameters in user interfaces is by using dialog boxes. But as we saw in the little demo I gave about this
size command,
it's very cumbersome because you have to go through this, get the dialog box, specify the values in the fields, then click OK or apply, and then see the result, and then many boxes are modal. It means while the box is up, there's nothing else I can do. And so oftentimes this is a problem. For example, if you do the save as, you want to save your document as something, and then the box shows up, and the information about the name you want to give to the file is in a part of the file that is hidden, but you're stuck and cannot go back there. You have to cancel and then restart. So the fact that it's modal is also a problem. And then dialog boxes have a tendency to grow bigger and bigger and bigger with every new release of the software. And so then you're faced with very big dialog boxes. So how do you structure them? Well, one option is to do what's called optional parts, where you have the standard commands here, and then you have more exotic things in the part that you can hide or you can show. That's very nice. One thing you have to do if you do this, if you want to do it right, is remember how the user left the box, so that next time you show it in the state it was left in. So optional parts are fine, and then there's a horrible tabbed dialog boxes. People who did this should go to jail. It's insane. So the idea is that there are different sets of parameters in different tabs. So why is this bad?
If you only have the OK button for every tab, you change some parameters in one tab, you change to other tab and modify your parameters, and then maybe you're not sure if the first parameters are applied or not, so then the apply button comes in and you...
Yes, and essentially you don't know what you're doing. Yeah. And this is due to the fact that it's not clear what the OK button does. Are you saying OK just to this tab or to other changes you may have done in other tabs? And some work in one way, others work in another way, so you can't really predict what's happening. Sometimes the changes happen just by going to another tab. It assumes that you're done with this one, it makes the change. So it's completely unpredictable. It's not giving you any feedback. If this had to be done the right way, consistently with dialog boxes, the OK should be OK for the whole thing, right? But then, at least, they could give you feedback in the tabs of which one has had changes made to it. And maybe the places you have changed should be highlighted as well, so you know what it is you're doing. I mean, as is, it's hard enough with one pane dialog box, but when you have multiple like this, it's just impossible to keep track of things. And I think in general, the bigger problem is that this is something that has not been designed. I've counted in Word that there's a dialog box with tabs where you have 80 controls. Now that tells me that the designers just gave up. Say, okay, we're going to throw this in the face of the user, and you know they won't be able to complain that they don't have enough control. We're giving them all the control. Yes, we're giving them all the control, but this is not design. Design is about choice, and it's about structuring information. So if you have things like this, it means you haven't finished your work. So as I showed in my little example with the text size, there are better ways of handling property and parameter specification. And it's called property boxes or inspectors. And one way that you've seen, including in Word or Excel here, I have this this inspector to the right. So here it's telling me that the name of the font, the size, whether it's bold, etc. If I click on text that is bold, the bold highlights, so it tells me it's highlighted. If I take, this is bigger, different font, so it tells me it's avant-garde. And so I can very easily act here and see the effect here in real time.
What does it do if you select text that is bold and that isn't? same time.
Well, let's try. Well, it thinks it's not. Which tells me, well, what should it be?
Maybe it should like be a half bold, half flat, like a circle, you know, so you see it's mixed.
I think it only shows the same stuff.
When you click the button now, everything is bold.
Right.
Yeah, I think the message here is that it's considering the text not bold. So if I hit bold, it will bold everything. Which is, so there is this, you know, consistency. But you're right, when the selection, when you have multiple selection or like for text, and you cannot reflect more than a single value, you get into problem. Now there's a paper I can refer you to, work that's been done very recently by actually a former student of mine, that has done an inspector where when you select multiple objects, all the different values are displayed. And so it would, you know, highlight both bold and non-bold. It would have a different thing for non-bold. And using that, you can do all sorts of selection and changes in a quite interesting way. But you have to read the whole paper or watch the video if you're interested in that topic. So the point here with those inspectors is to have the state of the inspector reflect the state of the selection with this caveat that if you have multiple selection, it can be complicated, and allow you to directly act on it. And in fact, again, we're reinventing the wheel because that's what was since day one in Xerox Star, where every object had a property sheet, and there is an OK button here. When you click something, it affects the object immediately. Last bit before we take a break, transformation tasks. So this is something I didn't know where to throw it in because it didn't fit in any of the other tasks. And essentially when you have objects that have, for which you want to control the shape, well, a very common way of doing this is by adding handle to the object. And so you've seen this before, a rectangle, you give it 8 handles. A polygon shape, you put a handle on each vertex of the shape. And for a curve, you can have not only the control points here, but for each control point, you can have the something that controls the tangent of the curve at that point. And the length of this, if I stretch this, it will make the curve flatter around the tangent here. So the general notion is that you are giving users a more direct control over the shape by using control points that are adapted to the shape you're doing. If it were a circle, you could have a control point for the center and one and somewhere on the circle itself. If it's an arc of a circle, you could have the endpoints, etc., etc. Now the thing is that there are a number of cases where you can use this geometrical shape to control complex parameters. For example, in Photoshop, you have curves that change the contrast of an image. So the curve is in fact something of that nature. It's a bit more constrained, but it's more like this. And you can edit the curve, you can either draw it by hand, or you can control it with a more smooth curve like this, or you can have predefined values. So the point I want to make here is that this geometrical transformation are not useful only for purely geometrical objects when you're editing shapes. It can be used to control more complex parameters like a transfer function, as I was saying, in Photoshop, or other types of multidimensional things. Okay, and so I think we're going to stop here to have a short break. Then I'll finish this on modes, and I'll show you videos from the conference I was at last week.
Be careful with the document, you let it bold all the text.
Yeah. It's already been sent, so.
Ah, okay.
But yeah, you're right. I should. Thank you.